From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
And terrified as I am of Muslim fundamentalists as a Muslim, I must also say that I'm equally terrified of the fundamentalism of the market.
Today on the War and Peace Report, an hour with Farid Issak, a leading Muslim liberation theologian. He's from South Africa, a former fighter with the African National Congress. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations and humanitarian organizations are urging the U.S. to stop using the devastating anti-personnel cluster bombs it's been dropping on the Afghan capital of Kabul. Taliban spokespeople say U.S. bombing killed at least 36 people in two villages near the western city of Herat. U.S. jets also hit a bus in Kandahar this morning, killing at least 10 civilians. The U.N. is estimating that a million people have fled their homes because of U.S. bombing, emptying major cities as refugees mass at the borders. And the Bush administration is turning to the Advertising Council, a New York-based nonprofit that develops advertising strategies for national causes, about crafting a public diplomacy campaign on the war in Afghanistan. Overseeing the talks are Charlotte Beers, the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy, and a former J. Walter Thompson advertising exec who started in the industry marketing Uncle Ben's rice. The Washington Post reports today a chemical additive in anthrax spores mailed to the Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle involves sophisticated technology thought to be available in only three countries, including the United States. Federal officials now appear to be looking more closely at the possibility that the attacks are the work of right-wing groups here in the United States. And this news from Ireland, the IRA announced yesterday it's put some weapons beyond use in what's widely seen as a historic breakthrough for the Northern Ireland peace process. The move could lead to the restoration of Northern Ireland's power-sharing executive if unionist parties agree. We're joined right now by Gretty Horgan, human rights and peace activist. Can you talk about the significance of yesterday's announcement?
Yes, well, it's really a huge breakthrough for peace here in Northern Ireland. Basically, over the last 4 or 5 years, actually for the last 7 years, there's been a great level of peace here, with the IRA guns being entirely silenced. However, there's been a sort of a push from mainly the unionists, and particularly the anti-agreement unionists, those who really don't want to see power sharing and don't want to see civil rights here, have used the question of the IRA arms not being decommissioned as a block for progress on the development of new structures here. And really what's great about the decommissioning of the IRA arms is not so much what it means in terms of the availability of arms for anybody who does want to be involved in terrorism. After all, they can just go and buy some more if they want to do that. But what it does do is it sort of takes away the excuse from the anti-agreement people who haven't wanted to see a new society emerging here in Northern Ireland.
Gretty Horgan, we also understand two people were arrested yesterday in County Down. Who were they?
They were Republican dissidents, and they were arrested with a submachine gun in the car. I think what that really says is that the real IRA people, and they are a very, very small group. They represent a tiny minority on the island of Ireland. And really, the fact that they were arrested as they drove along a motorway suggests that the police knew exactly who they were and what they were going to do. And one of the reasons why very few people in Northern Ireland are concerned about these dissident Republican groups is because clearly they're infiltrated at every level by the security forces, by the secret police.
Gretty Horgan, finally, you have worked for peace in Ireland for more than 30 years. You have organized trade union rallies before the ceasefire that brought tens of thousands of people into the streets. Do you think that yesterday's breakthrough will make a major difference at this point?
As I said earlier, I think the main breakthrough is in terms of the atmosphere here and the fact that those who have been trying to resist a more just and equal society here no longer have the excuse of the fact that the IRA had not decommissioned any arms. Now the ball is back in their court. Are they willing to accept, for example, more human rights legislation? Are they willing to accept that we need to have legislation that's going to ensure equality between Catholics and Protestants, between men and women? Are they going to just throw up more obstacles? And already, I'm afraid, there are some signs that some of the unionists are going to be throwing up more obstacles, and they're saying that this isn't enough. You know, they want evidence that the IRA is completely broken up, you know, that it no longer exists and stuff like that.
Garrity Horgan, I want to thank you very much for being with us, speaking to us from Derry, Northern Ireland, human rights and peace activist, as we move now to Edwin Starr's War.
Then, of course, there is revolutionary love. Love of comrades fighting for the people and love of people. Not an abstract people, but people one meets and works with. When Che Guevara talked of love being at the center of revolutionary endeavor, he meant both. For people like Che or George Jackson or Malcolm X, love was the prime mover of their struggle, and love cost them their lives. Love, coupled with a man's pride. Love, coupled with a man's pride.
Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. We are the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In the 6 weeks since the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the mainstream media has flooded the airwaves and newspapers with glib commentary about the nature of Islam. President Bush assuring Americans that Islam equals peace and whether or not the Taliban or groups like Al-Qaeda are authentic Muslims. Just this morning, AP, for example, quoted an influential Shiite Muslim cleric once linked to Islamic militants who said he doesn't believe the September 11th hijackers committed an act of martyrdom, which he says is a prized duty in Islam, but suicide, a crime in the faith. The media has spent much of the time contrasting moderate and by implication legitimate Muslims in the West with militant and by implication illegitimate Islam in Central Asia and the Middle East. But as Professor Edward Said has noted, there's no one Islam, but a plurality of Islams reflecting a plurality of religious and political agendas. We now turn to Faridi Saq. He's a Muslim scholar who's lived the diversity of Islam from Pakistan to South Africa and developed what many call an Islamic theology of liberation. Joining us in our Firehouse studio, welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile.
Thank you very much, Amy. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you with us. I should also say Faridi Saq is in New York as a visiting scholar, visiting professor of theology at Auburn Seminary. A leading Muslim figure in the anti-apartheid struggle, active member of the ANC, and in the last 4 years has been the head of the Gender Equality Commission of the South African government. Well, first, I'd just like to get your reaction to the September 11th attacks. Where were you when they happened?
I was in Manhattan. I was in Uptown Manhattan. And although I had been to New York several times, I had never seen Twin Towers. I think I had been spared that sight. And so it was surreal. It was TV, it was film, it was drama. I must also say that the afternoon of the attack and the subsequent days, although I was deeply pained by what I saw, just a few days before that, I was in the southern Sudan and in the north of Uganda. And there I saw, if you're looking for a real atrocity, There I saw the devastation on thousands of Christians wreaked by the Sudanese regime. And I also saw the devastation wreaked by the Lord's army in northern Uganda. A Christian fundamentalist group, every bit as obscurantist as the Taliban. And the thing then that struck me very vividly was how those are black lives. And the fact that there are hundreds and thousands in the last few years that have been killed, it just doesn't matter. They're not white lives. There are no TV cameras. There are no fundamental economic objectives being threatened. And so, although my heart goes out to all the pain that I see around me, I couldn't be helped but be struck at how indifferent people are to black lives, to cheap lives, and now we see to Afghani lives, really. I mean, when they're not white and when the TV cameras aren't around, when it doesn't... So I must say I was very ambivalent in being caught up in all the pain around me, and at the same time, the memories of northern Uganda and southern Sudan still very much a part of my experiences of those days.
Can you talk about how you, as a Muslim and a scholar of Islam, explain the attacks and the deeply conservative variant of Islam practiced by the Taliban and others in the region?
Incidentally, I spent 8 years in a theological seminary where in many of the Taliban people studied with me. Some of my professors are now ministers in the Taliban government. So I know much more than what meets the eye.
Where?
In Pakistan.
Where in Pakistan?
In Karachi and also in the north of Pakistan. I think that it is part of a fundamentalist mindset. A mindset that, in the case of the Afghans, it's also a combination of tribalism and a mythical sense that religion provides you with a sense of rootedness and essence, a stability, absolute truths in the face of whether it is the vicissitudes of time, of war on the one hand, or of modernity on the other. But I dare say that it is not a mindset that is peculiar to the Taliban or to Muslims. It's a mindset that at its raw manifestations you see in the Jerry Falwells, you see it in the Pat Robinsons, and I dare say you also see it in the discourse of your president. This whole caricaturing of absolute rightness, absolute goodness on the one side and absolute evil on the other side. I mean, really, this is the shades of the same coin. But you didn't ask me about your president. You asked me about Islam. And the reality is that that there are many strands in Islam, as Edward Said says. I, for example, have spent much of my life working against all forms of religious fundamentalism. I don't like the term moderate. I'm not a moderate. I'm a radical Muslim. I am bitterly opposed to all forms of religious obscurantism. I hate all forms of discrimination, whether it is against transvestites or transgendered people or gay or homosexual people or women or black people. And I've spent my life opposing all forms of discrimination. I don't like the equation of an Islam that stands for justice with a wishy-washy Islam that doesn't take positions. I think that I don't like the idea that people, I mean, are all of a sudden saying that there is an Islam which is peaceful. Of course there is such an Islam, but it is not the Islam of the Saudi establishment. It's also not the Islam of President Bush. I believe in an Islam that is prepared to wage struggles for justice. In South Africa, for example, we speak about the gender jihad. There are many, many mosques in South Africa. where women aren't allowed to worship. And it is a sacred struggle to ensure that women have their legitimate places within society as a whole, but also within our mosques. And so I'm also a Muslim that believes in jihad. I know it's not a very attractive thing to be saying, but I think that in a world where there is so much injustice, for us to say that we are moderates in the face of this injustice, this is acquiescence, this is an evil.
Explain what is meant by jihad.
Jihad literally means a sacred struggle. And for me, it is a struggle to establish justice in the world, but not a justice for Muslims, not a justice for white men, not a justice for men, but a justice for the very many marginalized people that exist in the world. And this may change from society to society. If, for example, I would be sitting in Paris with a whole bunch of middle-class Arab men, the marginalized in that context may well be Jews that they are demonizing or engaging in a whole blanket rubbishing of and kill the Jews. I would not hesitate to, in that context, speak my truths. And the Prophet, for example, said in a hadith, in a prophetic saying, that the best jihad is to speak the truth in the face of tyranny. And that, in that context, it is that kind of tyranny. I do, however, think that this kind of, more specifically, if you were to ask me if what the Taliban is engaging in or what Osama is engaging in is a jihad, no, I don't. I think this whole, it is not, there is no intention to establish a just order. The way in which they've dealt certainly with women in Afghanistan, the way they engage in the blanket rubbishing of all Jews and Christians and people who don't believe, the way they have stoned to death people that have been quote-unquote caught in male-male sexual acts in the Sudan, in Afghanistan, all of those testifies to the fact that the world that they seek to create is even more horrific than the world that they seek to destroy. And so, no, it is not a jihad. Jihad has two forms. The one jihad is a struggle against yourself, and the other jihad is a struggle against all forms of tyranny around you.
We're talking to Farid Issaq. His book is Quran, Liberation and Pluralism. He is a longtime freedom fighter in South Africa, leader in the ANC, the African National Congress, who is the commissioner of the Commission on Gender Equality over the last 4 years in South Africa. And as he's just said, trained for many years in the madras of Pakistan, where a number of the Taliban also were educated. Let's go back to that. Can you talk about who these men are?
One of the things about madrasa life in general is that broken people generally take to madrasa education. And that's not a bad thing in itself. I think that many people in Christianity take to the ministry because their lives are broken and they're seeking for wholeness. But this is compounded in this particular case with enormous poverty, but one should also bear in mind that the Taliban are the children of war, that they are the children of broken families, they are the children of refugees, they are the dispossessed chickens that are coming home to roost. And I don't think that it is savvy to ignore this whole legacy of refugeeness, of poverty, of devastation, and a war that was visited upon these people by the major powers at that time, one of them still around and one of them not around. And so when we see a social, a cohesiveness given to all of this brokenness, it is the children of war, the children of a violent, CIA-funded resistance to a war, but also the children of the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. This coalescing with ancient tribal machoism, the Taliban is the product of this. And I dare say, and I shouldn't excuse my own myself and my religious commitment, I think also the children of some violent impulses within our own faith, Islam. I think that it is dishonest on the part of many Muslims today to say that Islam is only about peace. The reality is that Islam, my religious background, it has violent strands in it that I, as a Muslim theologian, would have to confront and to think about, and what do we do with it? But I think that going the easy way and saying that Islam means peace, I don't believe that I would be truthful to my own conscience if I were to go that path.
Who is, for example, Mullah Muhammad Omar?
Mullah Muhammad Omar is not a very profound religious scholar. He was a local imam in Kandahar, studied in one of the madrasas in Pakistan, in the vacuum of his of Kandahar, the power vacuum that was there, or the chaos, the chaos of the Mujahideen government and so on. Mullah Umar, with his religious students in his own little madrasa in Kandahar, one day decided to organize people, and through that mobilized people against local corruption and so on. But I also think that it's important to bear in mind that often we personalize these things. But it's also the product of a whole nexus, the Pakistani intelligence agency and their own need for stability in Afghanistan, given the complex nature of the Pashtun dominance in the northwest frontier province of Pakistan and Quetta, and the tensions there and the separatist movement there with the south of Afghanistan. So it's a whole interaction of other forces at play there.
And what does Taliban mean?
Taliban literally means students. Normally applied to students of religious education. A talib is somebody in search, meaning in search of religious learning. Well, I mean, I think that they have a long time ago thought or worked on the assumption that they have found everything. And I think everybody in this world that has found all the solutions, I think they're a pretty dangerous breed, whether they're in Islam or elsewhere.
And madrasa, what does it mean?
Madrasa is a religious seminary. These madrasas, they run very much along the lines of 16th, 17th, 18th century Catholic seminaries. I mean, where for 6 days a week, we spend 8 hours a day in classes. We spend another 4 hours in compulsory learning. Our hostel rooms, we live 10 to 16 people in one room, and it's not a large room. They locked until 10 o'clock at night. Only then can we enter the rooms. We get awoken at 4 or 5 in the morning for prayers. A very rigid kind of regime.
And
we're not allowed to read newspapers.
And what does it mean not to have any girls there, any women?
Oh, I think that it's not just a question of not having any women there, but just a question of putting all of these men together. And exactly the same thing happens when you put men together in a prison or in a boarding school. In this particular case, with much more repression, of course. But it leads to distorted personalities. You begin to develop images of women as women just represent temptation. Women just represent evil. Women just represent threats to your sexual so-called purity. At the end of the day, I think it's understandable how this is reinforced then by the nature of ancient tribal societies. I mean, you know, in the northwest frontier province where many of the Pashtuns live, I've been there a couple of times, and people talk with pride of Chadar and Chardiwari, that the chadar is the black, the covering that women wear, and Chardiwari is four walls. People speak with pride about how their women are locked up behind these cloaks and four walls since the age of 8 or 9 and had never seen the sunlight. But sadly, we didn't develop an awareness or sufficient or not a sufficient enough awareness to actually do something about it, until things started falling apart downtown in our own terrain. And so, this is the tragedy, I mean, of the struggle of many, many women. people don't notice it until it doesn't affect men. It's only when men are affected or men's sense of power is affected. It's only then that all of a sudden we see a whole barrage of coverage on the plight of these poor women in Afghanistan.
We're talking to Farid Isak, and he was the head of the Commission of Gender Equality in South Africa for the last 4 years. Went from South Africa, where he was a leader in the ANC, then in the government, and before that in Pakistan. I'd like to talk to you about the transition you made there. And we're going to also talk about U.S. foreign policy when we come back here on the War and Peace Report. We can never beat these crooked politician men is to cast the money changers out of the temple, put the governor in. Oh, it's Jesus Christ, our president, God above our king, with the job and a pension for young and you are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're here with Farid Isak. He's in the United States as a visiting professor of theology at Auburn Seminary in New York. He's a leading Muslim figure in the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, a prominent Muslim scholar, and author of the book Quran, Liberation, and Pluralism, an Islamic perspective of interreligious solidarity against oppression. He was educated for 8 years in the madrasas of Pakistan, where he knew a number of the people who are in the Taliban leadership right now in Afghanistan. Is there someone you'd like to talk about that you knew that's there now that you're following in the news?
No, not particularly, in part because, I mean, one of the problems that I have, Amy, is we often tend to personalize these things and we say, you know, it's like the story of the bad king and the good king. And once upon a time, there was this bad king, and his name was Gaddafi. And after him or before him, there was another bad king. His name was Khomeini. And then another bad king came, and his name was Saddam Hussein. And now we've got another bad king. His name is Osama. And then there was a good king before, and his name was George Bush. And he really whipped the ass of the bad king. And then his son came along afterwards. The baby bear came along and then whipped the ass of the other bad king. I think that we tend to, we often reduce history to a whole drama of bad kings and good kings, whereas there are many, many other forces that, of course, this kind of thing makes for good TV coverage and good simplistic analysis of things and so on. But the reality is that there are many, many other forces at work that gives rise to these things and that shape our responses to these things. I mean, you look, for example, at the whole Gulf War and so on. At the end of the day, it was about gas and the price of petrol in the United States and nothing about freeing Kuwait. Kuwait is still as much enslaved as Kuwait was before and afterwards.
And Saddam Hussein is still
Saddam
in
Hussein
Iraq.
Saddam Hussein is still around. Gaddafi is now a friend of ours. The other bad king's son took over in Syria. And his son is equally bad, but has just been elected onto the Security Council of the United Nations without the veto of the UN. Then we had the other bad king, of course, there in Sudan, Turabi, still around recently. They've been taken off our list of terror-supporting nations. So it depends entirely on which way we want to go and who serves our interests at a particular time.
Well, I'd like to talk more personally about you. How did you go from South Africa to Pakistan?
I was a child, always deeply religious, but also always had a very strong political awareness, a sense of injustice around me. In fact, Amy, I was 13 years old when I first went to jail, when I was picked up at school by the security police and detained.
And where were you?
I was in Bontia, but in a poor township. I come from a very impoverished background in South Africa. But I also had a sense that of the power of religion over over people. And in some ways, I think, like many other people who take to religion, also a broken person, if truth be told, and also seeking for wholeness within religion. And so I was about 15 years old when I went to Pakistan to go and study and live in this. But you can also imagine the devastation that it wreaks on a 15-year-old to be living in an environment like this. And I was there until I was 23 years old, came back, was principal of another seminary in South Africa. And after just a year, the liberation struggle was really taking off in a big way, and I simply couldn't see myself trapped in a seminary. It was then that I founded an organization called the Call of Islam that played perhaps the leading role in mobilizing Muslims in the struggle against apartheid. But interestingly, I had two other platforms. The one was gender justice, and the other one was environmental justice. And so for much of the 80s, I spent my life either in and out of detention or in the trenches of the liberation struggle.
And what about that, in the trenches of the liberation struggle? The ANC, considered, let's not forget, in this country, a terrorist organization for many years, and even with the laws passed now, since September 11th, that talk about if you have ever in the past aided a terrorist organization, that would include the ANC.
And that would include the icon of humanity in the world today, Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela, we must not forget, Nelson could have been freed from jail at least 10 years before he came out. But Mandela refused to denounce in a principled manner the armed struggle. And so, yes, the ANC also has a history of armed struggle, for want of a better word, if truth be told, a history of violence. And it may now be easy for us to denounce all forms of violence, as I, for example, am wont to do. And at the same time, I think that it was useful for us in our liberation struggle. But Amy, I must say that since then, I have seen how even on our own side, those cadres of ours, those comrades of ours, I have seen what it has done to them. I have seen how, you know, people often talk about the miracle of South African society, how, oh, isn't it wonderful that you guys avoided this bloodbath? We haven't. If you look at the gender violence in South Africa, if you look at the horrific rape figures in South Africa, if you look at the domestic abuse figures in South Africa, that war is continuing in our homes. And so I think that we are still seeing the cheapening of human life under apartheid. But I'll be honest, Amy, we are also seeing how we in the liberation struggle glorified violence. And so if I had a chance to live my life over again, I would be very, very careful before I again support an armed struggle. I would think very hard about whether people are just taps that you can turn on and off. The one moment you say jihad against apartheid, and you know that the subtext of it is a violent struggle against apartheid, and the next moment you say, okay guys, cool it now, the jihad is over, back to normal. Because people tend to often internalize, I mean, violent ways of doing things. But again, I mean, I would say if I were to live my life again, I'm not quite sure if I would to would I be able to arrogate to myself the right to go and tell this to somebody in Palestine, for example. I know I'm going on and on, but let me just make one quick point. You know, my niece, she was very young. She was 12 years old when she was snatched from her bedroom in the middle of the night by somebody that had broken into the window, taken across to a field and raped on the field at knife point. In the middle of this, she had the presence of mind to, when the rapist dropped his knife, she took the knife, and it's a very gory incident to be narrating, but this is the reality of the world that we're living in. and she stabbed him in his back. He jumped up, and she then ran. I don't know, Amy, with all my post hoc insights into violence and understanding of what it does to people, I don't know if I would be able to tell my niece then, you should not have used the knife of that man to save yourself from being raped any further. I'm saying that I have all of these insights now, but I don't know if I can glibly go around the world and tell other people how they should be dealing with their own struggles for humanity and for justice.
We're talking to Farid Isaac, who is a Muslim liberation theologian from South Africa to Pakistan, South Africa, now here in the United States. You became head of the Commission on Gender Equality.
Chief Executive Officer, yes.
CEO. What was that commission, and how does that fit into your life and your religion?
I was 3 weeks old when my father left my mother with six sons. And then I was about 4 or 5 years old when, under the Group Areas Act, we were thrown literally into the wilderness, leaving a stable community because we had to make place for white people in that area. And then I was at school when my mother died of a heart attack on the factory floor. She left very early in the morning from what we say to Can't See, and she returned home at night after Can't See, from dark to dark. And then there's a very painful story also. When I returned from Pakistan, in my early 20s, I was called into a room by one of my brothers and says, look, Farid, there's something that we must tell you. And we have a sister. What do you mean we have a sister? My mother actually had a daughter before she was married. But the shame and disgust and the horror and the evil of having a child before you are married. And of course, we say, you know, she became pregnant. It's never he impregnated her. We talk about women as if they're all Virgin Marys, you know, immaculate conceptions. Men aren't responsible for it. It's just women who become pregnant, isn't it? And so this woman, her existence was buried all our lives until after my mother died. And so all of these things really also go into who I am. And so in many ways, my own commitment to gender equality is in some ways this woman, this mother of mine who died, and this is not a cliche for us, as a victim of the triple oppression of women, patriarchy, apartheid, and gender. So my life is a continuation of the struggle for integrity and the struggle of existence that my own mother led. As for the Commission on Gender Equality, the South African Constitution is a wonderful constitution, perhaps the most progressive in the world. But it also seeks to create institutions that will ensure that notions of non-racialism, notions of non-sexism, that these notions become real in our society. And so to this end, the Constitution has set up several commissions, the Human Rights Commission, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and the Commission for Gender Equality. And so it's a constitutional organ. I mean, we get nominated by the public, interviewed in Parliament, and eventually appointed by the President.
The Constitution is one of the most progressive when it comes to women and also gays and lesbians.
Yes, absolutely. The South African Constitution was the first constitution in the world that discriminated, that outlawed discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. The very first, I mean, in many other countries you've got laws against such discrimination. The South African Constitution was the only one that enshrined it in its constitution. Just two things about that. Our then President Mandela was very, very clear about this, and certainly said that never again will any group discriminate against another group.
As a Muslim theologian, of course, it's a bit of a difficult one sometimes because, you know, our legacy, our theological legacy and our scriptures has what we sometimes think are explicit positions on this. I don't believe that these positions are explicit as what we make them out to be. But then I think we need to be honest. Muslims can't, in a new South Africa, demand a say for them as Muslims and then want to say, we want space to live our own lives out. And then say, yes, but those other types, faggots and queers, blah, 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 whatever derogatory terms we have for them, or not so derogatory terms, they can't have the space to be who they are. And I'm not saying that you don't get Muslims who are gays. I'm not saying that the one is not the other.
And AIDS is a major crisis in South Africa, as in many places in the world. How does that fit into the issue of gender?
Incidentally, I'm also a trustee of the Treatment Action Campaign. I'm one of three trustees. And the Treatment Action Campaign, you may be aware, led the struggle in the last few years against the pharmaceutical industries. And not in response to your question, but what has really angered me in the last days, it makes me feel bitter, in fact, is that for years we're waging the struggle in a continent that has two-thirds of the world's HIV population, HIV-positive population. For years we wage a struggle against the pharmaceutical industry, against patent rights and so on. All of a sudden, two people die in the USA because of anthrax, and the USA is threatening to revoke the patent rights of the company that holds these rights. It is horrific. Two people have died. Two Americans have died. And the USA is putting pressure on the pharmaceutical industry, reduce your prices, threatening that Congress will pass laws to void and denounce to void the patent rights of Cipro or whatever
Cipro Bayer Corporation
of Cipro Bayer, and then threatened us with economic sanctions. And I called last year for the illegal importation, the smuggling. I publicly called for the smuggling of cheaper antiretrovirals from Thailand for women who are HIV positive into South Africa. And we have initiated a movement of civil disobedience in South Africa to smuggle these drugs in. But it is very, very painful. I get very, very angry about this. In South Africa, of course, you know, well, in Africa in large, you know that the larger part of people that are HIV positive, they are women. In part, it is a reflection of both the economic vulnerability of women and the vulnerability of women in relationships. Women simply cannot negotiate safer sex with their husbands. It is also seen, you know, in broken societies, men, not only broken, but in throughout our patriarchy, our senses of who we are, the machoism, I am a man, the whole way in which this plays out in sexual relations. All of this means that women are the disempowered people. Women are vulnerable. And so in South Africa, in Africa at large, the question of this thing is not one of HIV AIDS, is not one of sexual morality, of what is right and what is wrong, but it is a matter of life and death. And if it deals with morality, then it is the morality or the immorality of gender injustice rather than this narrow obsession that religionists have about who uses what part of his anatomy to go into which part of whose anatomy on the other side.
We're talking to Farid Isaac, who is a leading South African liberation activist and liberation theologian who is Muslim and has written the book Quran, Liberation and Pluralism. You're here in the United States. You're going to be spending time here. You're going to be going to Palestine as well. Where?
I'll be based in Jerusalem next year for about 2.5 months. We always say, God willing, inshallah. And in this particular case, the controllers of passports and entries and so on at Tel Aviv Airport also willing. And I've always felt very passionately
about the Palestinian struggle, indeed as passionately as what I feel about the struggle to humanize all people. And why I'm saying this, Amy, is very often you have Muslims that feel passionately about the Palestinian struggle, but in a very, I think, in a very dishonest way. It's only because Muslims are suffering there. I think that when people are suffering all over, whether they are Jews or Muslims or Christians, as a human being, forget about as a Muslim, I should not be silent. And so I am vociferous in my denunciation of anti-Semitism. And it's a terrible thing amongst Muslims. It's a very insidious thing, anti-Jewishness. Anything goes wrong, you blame the Jews. But at the same time, one of the other interesting things that I find is every right-winger, from Japanese nationalism to Afrikaner racism, nearly every right-wing cause in the world always resort to the Jews as a final scapegoat.
For Frieda Sack, we have to break. We'll be back in a minute.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone. Lord, we don't need another meadow. There are cornfields and wheat fields enough to grow. There are sunbeams and moonbeams enough to shine. Oh, listen, Lord, if you want to know.
You're listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with the Muslim liberation theologian Fareed Isaac. If you were president of the United States, what would you do now?
First of all, I don't think that I'd ever want to have the dubious honor of leading the United States of America.
Well, you don't have to worry about being elected these days in the United States. That's not what it takes, a popular election, to be president of the United States.
Yeah, the other thing, of course, is one doesn't have to worry about having the support of the majority of people. The majority of people just don't vote in the United States. I think that one just has to be clear that you have the support of the correct lobbies in the United States. Not that that's really important, because lobbies also make sure that they have their bread buttered on all different sides. And so whoever comes in really is our man. But suppose we came to the leadership in a different kind of process, in a democratic process. I don't know. I think that one of the first things that I would do is I would enact laws that would talk to people, not laws to talk to people, but I would try to create a United States that is less great. I would try to create a United States that is smaller. I would try to create a United States that is less grand. The reality is this, that with 4% of the world's population and consuming 46% of the world's resources, we will always be having trouble. And it is natural. It is to be expected. It's not being vindictive when you say that if you comprise 4% of the world's population and walk away with 46% of its resources, it's a law of nature that you will get your comeuppance. I'm not saying that I want it like that, but no person does this and not face the consequences of it. So I would ask the country and work with the country on how do we become less great.
Conservatives in this country and in the Islamic world have talked about a clash of civilizations between the West and Muslim countries. You instead have talked about a clash of fundamentalisms. Can you explain what you mean by this?
I think that we generally have a picture of what we talk about when we speak about religious fundamentalism. Christian fundamentalism, Jewish fundamentalism, or Muslim fundamentalism. We have a pretty broad picture of what we mean when we talk about that. I have another theory, and that is that the market also operates as a religious fundamentalism. The market, certainly as we know it today in the era of globalization, it has a god. What is a god? A god is an entity that is the focus of your existence, that you try to please, that permeates your being, that you seek to worship. In the market, capital is at the center of our existences. You accumulate capital, you serve the interests of capital. Capital is the big value that determines your own worth as a human being. We judge people by how much wealth they have. That guy has made it. She's a very successful woman. And by successful, we don't mean is she a balanced person or a balanced personality, pleasant, unpleasant, good character, bad character. No. Successful is big bucks. And so you've got a religion. You've got a god at the center of it. But you also have religious symbols. You've got your McDonald's sign, you've got your Coke sign, and these symbols are very, very important. They are protected by patent rights. They are my symbols. Don't get into my territory. You have temples where people spend their time, reflection, meditating, worshipping. How much? The shopping malls, for example. These are our temples. You also have the most pernicious aspect of fundamentalism is its sense of self and its sense of how it excludes other people. And so there is paradise for some and there is eternal hell for others. You don't want to buy into the market economy? There is absolute hell for you. Any economy in the third world that doesn't adopt the standards of the IMF, the standards of the World Trade Organization, there is absolute hell for you. If we don't squeeze you out completely, we will impose embargoes upon you. The case of Cuba, for example, is a pointed example. And so we promise paradise for some, and for many, we promise utter hell. We promise paradise for most. But we also know that paradise is an elusive thing. At the end of the day, there is just paradise for a few. I mean, the world just has so much. The world doesn't have more than what it has. But it holds out the hope of paradise for the vast majority of people. You can get rich. It's like the lottery. People know that they've got 1 in 2 million chance of winning the lottery, but there is the hope. And religion functions in very much the same way. It holds out the sense of hope. And so, Amy, I believe that what we had seen on September the 11th is really a very vivid manifestation of the clash of a Muslim fundamentalism with the fundamentalism of the market. And terrified as I am of Muslim fundamentalism as a Muslim, I must also say that I'm equally terrified of the fundamentalism of the market. We have seen what it has done to Africa. We have seen what it has done to Latin America. We've seen what it has done to Asia. And so I live in dread of both. Of course, when a Jehovah's Witness comes up to you on the street and gives you a pamphlet and says, take this, or I am chosen, you are frozen, it's my task to defrost you. You immediately say, no, I don't want it. But somebody comes to you and hands out to you, you know, here's the latest sale at Sainsbury or Bloomsbury or whatever, you take it. And so they have their proselytizers, their converts, I mean, the huge amounts of money that is spent on proselytizing. It's not called ads anymore, they just called, and will you hold on for the next message from our sponsors? Not even called an ad anymore. And so they've got their pamphlets, they've got their tracts, they've got their missionaries, and they're every bit as pernicious as what Muslim or Christian or Jewish fundamentalism is.
So what do you think should happen now? We're now, I don't know if you can call it at war with Afghanistan, but the United States government is bombing Afghanistan. They're also dropping some food on Afghanistan and some pamphlets.
I don't think that they were ever serious about dropping food. I don't think that anybody was really taken in by it, except for the Jerry Springers of this world and your other people of that ilk, kind of humanitarian. We're giving food to the Afghans, but it was a ploy. 37,000 meals. It was a ploy that just happened on the first day, so nobody was ever taken in by it. I think that this cup will come to pass. We'll sit through it. I mean, I was at an anti-war rally a few days ago in San Francisco. It was wonderful. I think that it's amazing that there are voices, isolated as they may be, that are continuing to speak. But we're speaking more for the crime of being silent. But this cup shall come to pass, and then after that, people like me and you, people like the listeners of this radio, other people throughout the world who are committed to creating a just world, a world where it is safe to be children, we shall pick up the pieces and continue to engage in our struggles. And yeah.
Will you continue to speak out against the bombing?
Absolutely. I think that not because we're going to succeed. You know, Amy, in the years of struggle against apartheid, we didn't fight that battle because we knew we were going to win. We had no idea we would see a non-racial and a non-sexist South Africa in our lifetime. But we fought because our integrity was at stake. And so we're speaking against the war, not because anybody is going to listen, but we're speaking against the war for us to retain our faith in ourselves as human beings.
Fareed Isaac, he is a leading anti-apartheid figure in South Africa, spent 4 years as the head of South Africa's Commission on Gender Equality, and a leading Muslim liberation theologian. His books include Quran, Liberation and Pluralism, and On Being a Muslim. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video cassette copy of this interview or a video of Noam Chomsky's speech or the speech we played earlier this week by Howard Zinn against war, you can call 1-800-926-3921. That's 1-800-926-3921. Or you can go to the website and get the video cassettes at freespeech.org. And this latest news just in from the Pacifica home front. According to the Pacifica board chair, Bob Farrell, the executive director of Pacifica, Bessie Wash, has resigned. This news comes after Pacifica board member Pete Bramson said last night that he had been told that Bessie Wash had been fired. And that does it for the show. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro, and engineer Errol Maitland is at WBIX.org, where you can hear Democracy Now. You can also hear us at webactive.com. Special thanks to Amy Pomerleau at KPFA, Free Speech Radio news producer Aaron Glantz, and thanks to everyone at KPFA and affiliate station KFCF in Fresno, and to all the Pacifica affiliate stations. We are Pacifica. Special thanks to the Independent Media Center and our hosts here at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. We can be heard here in New York at WFMU 91.1 FM every night at 7 and on Manhattan Neighborhood Network Channel 56. We're broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. We're in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Lord, we don't need another meadow. There are cornfields and wheat fields enough to grow. There are sunbeams and moonbeams enough to shine. Oh, listen, Lord, if you want to know. That there's just too little of what the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some. Oh.